ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Thanks for tuning in to ID, the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, we're bringing to you part two of a fascinating conversation between Dr. Stephen Meyer and UC San Diego physicist Brian Keating that originally aired on Keating's podcast, Into the Impossible. Keating is Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at UC San Diego and author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize, A Story of Cosmology, Ambition, and the Perils of Science's Highest Honor. Dr. Keating's website is briankeating.com. The topic of their chat is Dr. Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. They speak for an hour and a half about a range of questions related to Dr. Meyer's work and his new book. Let's listen in to the second half hour now.
I just want to remind everybody, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute and author of Darwin's Doubt, Signature in the Cell, as well as the upcoming book, or now today's just released, fresh off the presses, as they say, Return of the God Hypothesis. We're going to talk about that word return in a moment, and because I think it's provocative, I want to ask you to visit Stephen on the web, on Twitter. We'll have his links on the YouTube version. Otherwise, please do subscribe to this podcast wherever you're getting it and leave a review. That's what helps us get great guests like Dr. Stephen Meyer and others like Lawrence Krauss, who I presume will come on and present a form of rebuttal. He plays not an insignificant role in this book, and he's a controversial character, a self-declared militant atheist, and one of the ones who I think, although I agree with your most recent mentioning of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is something, you know, that's not super well known to most, certainly most practicing experimental cosmologists, and yet is an example of something which I've encountered quite frequently, where there is sort of a teleological imposition that's placed, that you, once you have an idea, for example, the Hawking-Hartle no boundary proposal, which features prominently in this book, or in the Everettian many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is another kind of quantum mechanical a set of equations or framework, perhaps is the best way to describe it, that could potentially, according to some, explain the features of the universe we do observe. So when we look at it, the challenge that I have for you is that, again, there's nothing that says Wheeler-DeWitt is the ultimate expression any more than there was anybody who said that, oh, Hawking-Hartle made this beautiful no boundary proposal. What need then for a creator, as you mentioned in the book many times? And I have tremendous challenges to Hawking, but I'm afraid that you will leave yourself exposed to people who are not as friendly as I am, and they'll say things like, well, no one tells you that Wheeler-DeWitt is correct. In other words, there might not be a universal wave function. First of all, how could you interact with it? How could you parameterize it? In what type of a Hilbert space does it exist? While I agree with you that the challenge to Krauss and all, who popularized Mellenkin's idea, he wasn't the originator of those ideas, the universe from nothing, was that it presupposed the existence of a Hilbert space, of a mathematical entity, of the laws of nature. And I find it very weak tea, as you Brits, you're American, but you spent enough time in England to be an honorary Brit, as they say. So it's weak to say, well, okay, so now here's this one. It feels like a critic will say, you're cherry picking. You're saying, oh, because the Wheeler-DeWitt equation describes the properties which a universe must have, and all quantum mechanical systems are undeniably subject to initial value conditions and boundary conditions, that they'll say, well, okay, so what? So Wheeler-DeWitt are wrong, just the same way that Hawking and Hartle are wrong. So why are you cherry picking which physicist you choose to get your evidence for the mind behind the universe? If it's eternal, just like the stupid question that people always, oh, who created God? Well, God doesn't need a creator, right? So you wouldn't stipulate that there has to be a mind that creates the mind that created the matter. So anyway, how do you overcome that objection? That there's no saying that it could be epistemologically sufficient, or it could be parsimonious to believe that, but there's no evidence for it. We have no treatment, no ability to ascertain whether or not the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is as fundamental as the Schrodinger equation in that it has predictive power in the domain in which it attempts to be magisterial over which.
Right. Well, again, what I'm attempting to do is not to say that Wheeler-DeWitt is necessarily right. Mm-hmm. In fact, in near the end of my treatment with this, I raised some questions about whether this application of quantum, the analogy that's drawn between ordinary quantum mechanics and the origin of the universe is apt at all. because there are some disanalogies. In an ordinary quantum mechanical system, you have a detector, you have something emitting electrons or photons, you have an experimental apparatus, you've got double slits. In the quantum cosmological case, you have nothing at all. You have just the mathematics of quantum physics that you apply to try to explain the origin of the system rather than describing a system that already exists. But the point that I make is that if you take this as an alternative to the body of evidence that we have pointing to a beginning, and say, well, there's a different way of giving a cosmological account, then oddly, that account also leads to a theistic implication. In a sense, what I presented in the book is what I've called elsewhere a cosmological trilemma. The preponderance of evidence that we have from observational astronomy and from developments in theoretical physics and both based on both special and general relativity does point to a beginning. It suggests that is the most likely conclusion. And I think there is a good argument for theism based on the origin of the physical universe at a finite time in the past. But if you don't like that conclusion, if you opt for a different account, and the main account that's been given as an alternative to the beginning is one that tries to circumvent the beginning with a quantum physical account of the origin of the universe, that then also has a theistic implication. Now, a third approach to that is to say, well, as you mentioned, maybe all the possibilities that are described by the universal wave function exist in some possible world, the many worlds interpretation. And in a separate chapter, I show that if you go many worlds, you end up essentially with absurdities like Boltzmann brains and an inability to make any predictions or explanations of a phenomena in our event or in our universe. You end up having absurd science-destroying consequences. So you can't absolutely prove the existence of God, but the consequences of denying the existence of God, as a theoretical postulate at least, is a system of physics which ends up eating its own, which ends up destroying, for epistemological reasons, our ability to rely on our own reasoning capabilities about the world around us. So at the end, the choice is between God and science, or no God and no science. So that's the sort of argument that I construct in the book. Now, there are obviously the other thing that I'm critical of in the book is the tendency among some theoretical physicists to create kind of mathematical castles in the air based on zero evidence and then say, well, because I can create these mechanisms, that provides a better account of things than, say, what we are getting from your field, observational cosmology, which are these strong indicators of the beginning. Well, maybe so, but at some point you have to weigh the epistemological weight of the speculative mathematics against the evidential arguments considerations that we have coming out of observational mm-hmm. astronomy. So I'm not, and this is where I think it's very important to point out that if the standard here is absolute apodictic proof of the kind you get reasoning deductively from mathematical axioms, you don't get that. You don't get that in science. You don't get that for a science-based argument for the existence of God. But what I'm arguing from is the preponderance of evidence and showing that if the best indications we have are of a beginning, and if the main alternative conclusions that we have, or the main alternative models that have been proposed as to explain away the beginning, both have theistic implications, then we have a strong argument. We have good evidence for a theistic conclusion, even if we don't reach the standard of proof, which is, again, unattainable both in science and in science, and in what you might call natural theology, science-based arguments for mm-hmm. God's existence.
When I think about the, you know, kind of approach that atheist scientists, self-declared militant or otherwise, take Stephen Hawking, and speaking of edifices in the sky, I mean, no one was better at kind of slipping a slider by an unsuspecting lay audience than Stephen, because he was so charismatic, he was so brilliant, and he was so accomplished and such a brilliant writer. I only recently I started reading A Brief History of Time in 1988 when I was a teenager, you know, and I stopped reading it in 1988, and then I picked it up again in 2020. And I started reading, and I finished it and found it, you know, oh, these objections are trivial. So I was like congratulating my, you know, all it took is becoming, yeah. you know, a full professor of physics. That, but he's actually a wonderful writer. And, but the sophistication needed to understand, it's far beyond the fact that he would say things that, such as any equation in your book cuts the readership by half, but any mention of God doubles the amount of readers for the book. And of course, I only later came to the conclusion of what he was doing was really a sleight of hand. And it was, I believe, somewhat dishonest, perhaps intellectually, to do what he did. And I can say this because I wouldn't expect that you would say it, although you hint strongly at it, but you're too much of a gentleman to mention it and speak ill of the dead. I love Stephen. I am having on the first author of a critical biography of him called Hawking, sort of about the business of Stephen Hawking, which I call Hawking Incorporated. He calls Hawking's Charles Seif at New York University. Anyway, he'll be on soon. I think his book comes out a week or so after yours. But the problem I have with him is that he would use in A Brief History of Time this Hawking-Hartle cosmology as a way to obviate the need for a creator. As he said, if God has two roles, according to Stephen Hawking, who was not a great theologian, although I point out that he thought so much about God that he actually was an Israelite, because the word Israel in Hebrew means wrestles or struggles with God, and nobody struggled more with God than Stephen Hawking. And in fact, the last words of his book, that famous book, probably one of the most popular science books in history, sold three times more copies, as you point out, than Richard Dawkins' Blind Watchmaker or The God Delusion. It sold over 10, maybe 12 million copies to date now.
Both the monster bestsellers, yeah.
Yeah, it was, and it made a whole publishing company and a whole industry of popular science writing, which I benefit to this day. So at the risk of, you know, of killing the golden goose, I would say, you know, he, in that book, the final three words are mind of God. In other words, if this is proven to be true, that back in 1988, he believed that the Hawking-Hartle cosmology would obviate the need for God, because God had two purposes. One was to instantiate the universe, and the other was to instantiate the laws of physics. The latter he disposed of, according to him, in The Grand Design, another book with very strong theistic overtones and atheistic overtones. But speaking of A Brief History of Time, in that book, he goes through what I only later really recognized as, you know, after going through graduate school, basically, as he was doing this mathematical trick of transforming time in a calculational sense from proper time, from physical time, which we enjoy and right now, and we can do experiments on, and we can observe things like time dilation and other relativistic effects. And he converted it to this imaginary space, which is purely used for mathematical purposes to solve equations which otherwise cannot be solved without these techniques, known officially as Wick rotations, to the experts playing at home. And then he said, well, it's just a mathematical trick. And then literally, Stephen, a page later, it's, and now we see that there's no boundary to time, and therefore there was no need for a creator. Speaking harshly, and as I assume, you know, we'll find out when I read the rest of Hawking, which talks about him as a commercial entity, but he was not immune to using God as leverage to increase the influence of his books and his thoughts. In that book, that argument is really falling on deaf ears. And worse than that, Stephen, maybe you would comment on this, is that in the revised, updated edition 2016, he not only says that there's more evidence than ever for the no boundary theorem, but there's also more evidence for M theory and inflation. And I point out, this is 2 years after the Bicep 2 affair that I play a big role in. So
you do indeed. Yeah.
What about this need to have vindication, to have proof, et cetera? Why do you know, sort of these the headlines, you know, appear on page one? God is dead. There's no God, Hawking says. And then the response of the community falls on deaf ears, if at all, on page B17 of the Saturday edition.
Well, that was one of the things that you mentioned Lawrence Claros a minute ago, and I'm indebted to him for getting me into this whole subject of quantum cosmology. I've been studying it a bit, but in prepping for a debate, I read his popular book, and then that took me to Vilenkin, and then that got me not only I was fortunate enough to attend the lecture series that Hawking did in preparation of the release of A Brief History of Time when I was a grad student in Cambridge. So I've been aware of this for years, but in prepping for a debate with Krauss, I ended up getting into the technical papers on quantum cosmology, and that's reflected in the last three chapters of this book. And one of the things that I was shocked to find was that this idea of the idea that the Wick rotation that eliminates in an intermediate step in a longer calculation the implication of a singularity, but only in the domain of imaginary time or in the complex domain of imaginary numbers. that implication that he drew from that in The Brief History of Time played absolutely no role in his technical work with Hartle. Mm-hmm. But that was something that was purely offered for public consumption. And yet he, as he pointed out in the book itself, the idea of imaginary time and the depiction of the space-time geometry that is possible during that intermediate step in the complex domain has no physical meaning. And yet from that, Hawking drew a metaphysical implication, namely that there was not a beginning to the universe, and therefore there was no creator. But then he acknowledges that when you complete the mathematical manipulation, when things are converted back into the real time in which we live, the singularity reemerges. And this is one of the things that was actually also very interesting, is that the singularity is presupposed in all of the quantum cosmological modeling. They don't eliminate it. It's only in this popular work. And if I could just circle back to your previous very astute question about, well, you know, there's always a new cosmology. How can you draw any significant conclusion from the whole, you know, body of work in cosmology when things are constantly changing? One of the things that's not changing, that's a constant, is the need to account for the specificity of our universe as we find it. And specificity in mathematical terms is, in a sense, it's a rarity of condition among a vast ensemble of possibilities. And no matter which cosmology is invoked, there is a need to, what's called the cosmic winnowing problem. How do you winnow among all those possible ensembles of conditions and possible states of affairs? How do you account for our universe emerging out of all those mathematical possibilities? And that problem is ubiquitous. It cuts across the grain of different cosmological models. You find it in multiverse cosmologies where the multiverse is invoked, whether it's based on inflationary cosmology or string theory or the combination of the two. So you construct a multiverse cosmology to explain the fine tuning. But then it turns out that you need a universe generating mechanism to generate the new universes in the multiverse, and those generating mechanisms themselves require prior fine-tuning. So you have the need for specificity of condition, and it's left unexplained. And the same thing occurred, and this is what fascinated me in the cosmological case. You can circumvent the beginning problem, but only at the case of a deeper information problem. You have to account for the origin of the specificity that is included in the case of quantum cosmological models, the universal wave function. So some of these problems that are necessary to account for the origin of the universe at all, why we have something rather than nothing, and why we have a specified something rather than all the other things that could be, are not eliminated by any cosmological theory, and instead continue to beg the same types of questions about the origin of specificity of information, where in our experience, we know of only one cause for the origin of information, for the origin of specificity in that sense, for the origin of fine-tuning, and that cause is a mind. So there's a kind of incorrigibility of the same type of problems in all the cosmological models, and that's what I meant earlier when I was referring to a kind of that what I'd done in the book was construct a robust argument, one that was not dependent on one model versus another, but rather upon the need to solve certain basic classes of problems that are only solved in our experience by the postulation of mind or intelligence.
I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Meyer, the Discovery Institute, author of Darwin's Doubt, Signature in the Cell, and the latest book, Return of the God Hypothesis. Let's get to that title word, return, because, you know, for many of us, we never started off with the God hypothesis, and it's often made a great deal of, and you talk about this in the book, the God of the gaps, and how even the great Isaac Newton, who, you know, folks like Krauss disparage, you know, as a wanton torturer of counterfeiters, and even I've been known to poke fun at his alchemical explorations as well. Of course, he was, phenomenal scientist, but, you know, it's often been said that he was able to patch certain holes in the theory of universal gravitation by only invoking theories of God's intervention or angels supporting matter distribution. Now, I had heard that in the context of the static universe, the apparent static universe. I hadn't actually, until you brought to my attention this kind of offhand comments by Neil deGrasse Tyson and others of, you know, this failure and of how Newton stymied scientific progress because of this. Can you say something about the invalidity of that, the lack of scientific curiosity or good scientific practice in just accepting these folklore tales about Isaac Newton and his supposed appeals to the God of the gaps?
It's amazing, Brian. I've heard this story about Newton invoking either the action of angels or the direct action of the deity to remedy an insufficiency in his laws of gravitation, because as he examined the solar system, he saw that there were certain points when you'd get the outer planets in conjunction that would make the whole thing stable. And at that point, he would postulate the direct and specific idiosyncratic action of God to stabilize things. And then the solar system could continue to work according to the laws that he had otherwise discovered. I've been suspicious of this for a long time, because when I was in grad school, one of my PhD examiners in a tutorial said, if you miss Newton's theism, you've missed everything. He was devoutly religious. Yeah. But he was also, the whole point of the Principia was that he was arguing that the mathematical harmony of the universe, the mathematical principles that were evident in the universe, displayed the handiwork of God. So to say that the mathematical laws were insufficient and that they required episodic interventions and interposing of divine will to remedy instabilities in the system was contrary to his whole program of research. So I was always suspicious of this story. And so I decided to look into it myself. I got into the Principia, and lo and behold, he actually argues that the planetary system, he does point out that there are these perturbations that arise from time to time as the outer planets get into certain alignments. But he says it doesn't matter. The system as a whole is stable on the order of millions of years. He says for vast eons of time, and he never posits an episodic intervention of the deity to remedy the irregularity in the planetary system, an irregularity that would not be captured by his law of gravity. So it's just a myth. But to your earlier question about the word return, the title of the book invites interest in a story. And the story is that, quite contrary to the depiction of the relationship between science and religion that's offered by, for example, contemporary new atheists or by late 19th century historians, historians of science now recognize that theistic concepts, specifically Judeo-Christian concepts that were part of the milieu of Western Europe from roughly 1300 to 1750, were crucial to the rise of modern science. In particular, the concept of lawful order, the idea that there are three metaphors that are commonly used, and you find them in the writings of Kepler and Galileo and Boyle and Newton, metaphors like the laws of nature, or nature perceived as a clock, or a great mechanism, or the book of nature, all of these are metaphors of theological origins. There are laws of nature because there's a lawgiver. There is a sustaining, the deity is understood to be sustaining the regularities that we see. He's not an explanation for irregularity, but a deeper explanation for why nature is uniform in the way that makes science possible. Another key concept that came out of this period of the scientific revolution was the concept of intelligibility, that the early natural philosophers, mechanical philosophers, people today would call scientists, believed they could study nature and that nature would reveal its secrets, because there was a built-in rationality or design in nature that was the product of the divine mind, the same mind that had endowed in us rationality. So there was the principle of correspondence. There was rationality built into the universe, and we being rational creators made in the image of the rational creator who had made the universe that way could understand the order and design that he'd put into it. And thus Kepler spoke about the high calling of the scientist was to think God's thoughts after him. So these theological concepts were crucial to the rise of modern science, the development of systematic methods for studying nature. And that perspective, I think, was largely lost in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And the story of the book is the story of discoveries that I think should and are beginning to rightfully bring that perspective back. So there's a kind of arc to the story that theistic ideas helped inspire science. A lot of that theistic perspective was lost in the late 19th century with figures like Huxley and Darwin and in other fields, Marx and Freud. But much of that is now beginning to come back as scientists, I think, are again opening their minds to the idea that there could be purpose and design in the universe after all.
That was UC San Diego physicist Brian Keating hosting Dr. Stephen Meyer on his podcast Into the Impossible. Look out for part 3 of this conversation on an upcoming episode of ID the Future. Learn more about Brian Keating's work at www.briankeating.com. BrianKeating.com. Get your copy of Stephen Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, online at Amazon, BN.com, or wherever books are sold. Until next time, I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.